You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Mill Madison, welcome back to the show, sir.
Well, thank you for having me, Marty. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about a lot of things today. AI, is it real? Is it hype? Is it a mixture of the two? We've got the Fed, obviously. Warsh has taken the helm since we last spoke. We've got some micro stuff to talk about in terms of individual memory stocks that you're following. And then we can get into the fiscal side of things, how much debt the U.S. federal government is and how they can sustain that debt and all the entitlement programs that they've built up. And then probably ending it with Scott Bessent, recall for a new economic regime at the New York Economic Club a couple of weeks ago, which has been a hot topic in my circles. We covered it this morning on the weekly show I do with my partner John Arnold at 10:31, and I'd love to get your thoughts on that. But I think just starting with the hottest chick in the room right now, which is AI. How are you reading this?
Well, AI is definitely one of two main forces that I see driving markets right now. I think it's AI. And then what I want to just kind of encapsulate, because there's a lot of interplay, is just kind of geo macro stuff. And, you know, that's Iran, that's Ukraine, that's the Fed, that's fiscal deficits. And those are things that the reason I categorize those together is because they're not related to like earnings, right? So another simple way to say it is what's going on in the broad market, like broad macro, and what's going on with earnings and company specific. And earnings are all about AI. And I just cannot see a way that AI is going away. Like, I think there's a lot of people out there that are talking about, you know, who's going to be the winners, who's going to be the losers. And I do agree, that's not the easiest game to play. But I do think there are certain segments that it's very hard to argue. Like, for example, why SK Hynix at 4x PE should be trading cheaper than it is. Like if you say, Mel, what's the base case where Micron at like 7x forward earnings is just the earnings are going to fall off the cliff between now and the end of the decade? And I just can't picture that case, because it's like, okay, is it going to be open source or closed source? Who knows? But at the end of the day, if compute demand is going to just go up exponentially, it's going to need memory, unless you're stipulating that there's going to be some newfound memory like breakthrough. And I think if your kind of hurdle rate for investing in something is that it's impossible for some black swan new technology to take it out, then there's literally nothing to invest in. Like, you know, I mean, are you going to invest in Bitcoin? Well, quantum could come in. Are you going to invest in U.S. treasuries? Well, the government could collapse and all of a sudden Congress could say, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling. Are you going, like, if you literally want to say there's no black swan impossible downside, then you can't invest in anything. So I will grant you there could be some big memory breakthrough. But absent that, you have companies like Micron signing multi-year agreements, trading at 6-7x earnings. You have capacity growing at 200-300% a year, not capacity, demand of what people want growing at 200-300% a year, while capacity is only growing at 20-30% a year. And you have companies like Apple saying, we've got to raise prices. You've got, I mean, if there's not truly a memory shortage, if there's an Ed Zitron, you know, false narrative out there that this is all BS, then why is Apple raising prices? Like, because then there's no demand. Like, there's no problem. Why would Apple want to raise prices if this is all just going to collapse in the next 3 months? And I just can't see it. And I think Ken Griffin put out a post the other day about like the days of like hedge funds monitoring pocket or parking lots and saying, I'm betting on this quarterly earnings. Like, that's the old alpha. The new alpha is like looking at this stuff and taking longer term views. And I don't know if Micron's going to be $800 or $1,200 a month from now, but I'll bet it hits 3,000 in the next 12 months. I'll just bet it does, because it's just too cheap. It's just too cheap not to double or triple from here. And I think people that think, oh, it can't do it. You know, what has Bitcoin done? What did gold do between 1980 and 1971, when it was, we were taken off the gold standard in 1980, it went up 25x. And so I think people that think like these things have run their course, they have to look at the fundamentals. And Micron at 7 times, SK Hynix at 4 times, the Korean stock market, which is collapsing in the last 24 hours at 9% down, is now trading at the cheapest PE multiple it has in like the last 48 months. Like, everything just keeps getting cheaper, and people just want to say you got to sell because it's all a big bubble, and I just don't see it.
Yeah, I mean, the Ed Zitron call out is funny, because I've seen his commentary and him do the sort of the cycle of going through CNBC, Bloomberg, and getting clipped out on X, and he's saying there's nothing there, nobody wants these things. And then I'm juxtaposing that to my usage of it, which has gone up, I think, personally, exponentially, if you're just looking at all the agents and sub-agents we're running here. And then you project that forward of more people adopting this, particularly agents. And we're definitely not even at the 1% adoption threshold of everyday people. And then you think of like robotics and self-driving cars and all the compute.
And the memory demand there is like exponentially more. Like, it's it's ridiculous. And Ed, I've listened to, I'll be honest with you, I've probably listened to 30 to 40 hours of him on podcasts, because I do not want to listen to a bunch of bulls tell me how great AI is and just buy Micron. I want to listen to the people that are saying, here's the problem with the story. And he has certain points. But the thing about him is, one thing I'll say about him, he's one of the cleverest speakers I've ever heard. Like, he is so quick and fast with the remark, but he's so quick and fast with the remark that often you'll listen to him and you're not really processing what he's logically saying. Because if you really break down logically what he's saying, it really doesn't make any sense. Like, he basically says stuff like, well, Anthropic and OpenAI can never be profitable. That's one of his key arguments, that it's all a subsidized good. There'll never be the demand for it. It's never going to be profitable. They're the only buyers of compute. But then at the same time, he'll talk about how like open source models are much cheaper. People want to use them. Well, if AI actually has a use case, even if it is open source models, it still requires compute. It still requires the hardware. It still requires memory. Does that mean that OpenAI is going to be a $4 trillion company? I honestly don't know. He might be right. OpenAI might not be the best buy right now, right? I mean, like, if I was a private investor, and that's what I did for a number of years, was basically secondary market investments in large private companies, would I be telling people go into OpenAI and Anthropic right now? No, I wouldn't. But does that mean that AI is not going to happen? And I think if you go back, and people love to compare it to the dot-com boom, so let's compare it to dot-com. Did pets.com, you know, blow up? No. But did the internet, I mean, blow up meaning become a huge success, but did the internet become a huge success? Yes. And look at the top companies in the quote unquote Mag 7. You had Apple, that went public in like the 80s. Microsoft, same thing. These things went through that. They had huge market caps. They came out of it. You also had companies like Google that weren't even public until after the dot-com boom. Tesla, same thing. And so like the internet and everything that happened there was real, and it was a huge thing, and it became a big deal. Did we have a huge blow up top and then a collapse and then an even a slow but steady rise to even greater market. I mean, what was the NASDAQ when it collapsed? I think it was like 4,000 to like 30,000 today. Okay. So like you're telling me like, oh my God, look at the .com. You could have bought the NASDAQ at the very top of the .com boom and left it in your IRA if you're a 30-year-old guy and you're coming back and you're 50 right now, you've still got 10 years before you can access it. And it's up like, you know, what, almost 10x. So I think if you zoom out and you look at what's going on, AI is not going away. Crypto is not going away. Bitcoin's not going away. The fiscal mess we're in is not going away. It's getting worse every day. That debasement trade that was so hot last year that let gold get over $5,000 an ounce, Bitcoin over 120, silver over 100, that's not going away. It's just we're going through all these micro rotations. And every time something happens, like Meta says, oh, we're cutting back on compute. And then it, you know, skyrockets, you know, 20% in the next two trading days, which is what Meta did. You know, it's the money's rotating. And the thing is the money's got to go somewhere. And the money just keeps building. It's the 401ks. It's now the Trump accounts. It's the fiscal deficits. It's this whole merry-go-round that has led the S&P to go from 666 in 2009 at the GFC lows to over 7,600 today. It's going to keep happening. And if you let yourself get shaken out every time there's a 20 or 15% pullback, I think you're just missing the big picture.
Yeah. I mean, before we get into Trump accounts, which I know you want to cover with those passive flows that many people aren't talking about. And I've said this multiple times over the last 6 months, like this seems like an equities market, not like a bailout, but like a mechanism to produce passive flows. But before we get to that,
the Ponzi needs more sources.
Yeah.
And that's a good one.
Yeah.
And that's a they're going to keep doing it. So you want to fight it, go ahead.
But like bring it back to like Zitron and some of his criticisms, like one of which being a lot of these companies, particularly the hyperscalers, have gone from buying back stock to hitting the ATM, to issuing stock, raising equity, and even going into more debt. And they're highlighting that as like, oh, this is the end. And I've been thinking about this a lot too, because you do want to check your priors and be like, okay, where am I maybe having a blind spot here? But like when I see that, it's like, you could take that signal that way, which is like these companies are desperate. They're diluting equity holders to raise cash to keep piling money into a loser is what Zitron would say. But the other one is like, well, maybe there was just a period of time post 2008 where the allocation of capital warranted and the sort of risk matrix that these companies have warranted, like, hey, we just buy back stock, try to juice EPS. And now there's finally an opportunity to deploy capital into not only deploy capital, but deploy capital at scales that we haven't seen that makes sense to do this. So like just trying to get in the mind of like the boardrooms of the hyperscalers specifically and that decision around buying stock back or hitting the ATM, raising debts, and does the opportunity of the AI infrastructure build out, is it so large that it warrants these types of actions?
I mean, everybody used to complain when they were doing all these buybacks, like they have nothing to invest in and it's a bad sign because they're buying back stock. And now it's like, oh, no, well, they're not buying back stock anymore. And so, look, I mean, Apple to me just hitting new highs today and it's up over 50% in the last year. I mean, like that's something I want to stay away from. Like we just keep going through these micro rotations and it's like, OK, Apple's going to have to raise prices. It's up over 50% in the last 12 months. It's at an all-time high. Like, maybe I want to go into other things. About a month ago, I basically said, I think this sell the suppliers narrative is overdone. And look to buy Amazon, Meta, Google, and Microsoft. And they're breaking out. I mean, these stocks have not made a new high since October. They're still not at new highs. So I do a little tweet once in a while that's essentially just a basic basket of the four hyperscalers and look at where they're at. And they are up well over 10% from the lows just like 10 days ago. They are not yet breaking out. And I think that there's two things that I think Zitron has wrong, and I think the market gets concerned about that they shouldn't. One is debt. I did a post a few weeks ago where I basically said, how long would it take for each of the hyperscalers to pay off all of their debt off of cash flows if they stopped AI spend? And every single one of them could pay off every dollar of debt they've raised within 2 quarters with free cash flow. Meaning, if all of a sudden AI is a bubble, AI is stupid, it all sucks, and we're going to essentially, we're Google, we're Amazon, Meta, we've raised some debt, how long would it take from free cash flow, essentially our paycheck, if we were employees, to pay off our credit card bill? The average is like 3.2 months. And they could all pay them off within less than 6 months. Now, what happens after 6 months when they're now debt free? Now they're going to trade at price to earnings. And then you look at a Meta and you say, oh, it's trading at 18 times or 20 times. And now they have no more AI spend to do. They have no more debt to pay. They have no interest expense. And that's if AI fails. So if Zitron's right and AI is this big nothing burger, and the big, everybody's going to, he's said things like, we're going to look back in a few years and say, what the hell were we doing building all this compute? Well, then number one, you got to take away the threat, right? You got to say, well, there's no threat to Google, because people might say, well, Google's, no, if AI is a nothing burger and it's going away, then Google's going to still have its moat. Amazon's going to have its moat. Microsoft's going to have its enterprise software moat. So if AI is truly a nothing burger, as Zitron says, then there's no threat to the business model of the hyperscalers. If AI is truly a nothing burger and they can literally pay off all of their debt and go back to these free cash flow monsters buying back their stock with both hands within 6 months, then what is the risk buying Meta below a market multiple? Like, there is no risk then, if that's the narrative he paints. Now, he doesn't really talk about another narrative, which I actually think could be the actual narrative that plays out, which is that AI is going to become this ubiquitous, huge force, greater than the internet, greater than, you know, the typewriter, the word processor, a lot of the recent big inventions, maybe even greater than radio or TV. Going back to the railroads, I think, is what a lot of people think is the best analogy. If it really is the greatest technology since the 1800s and the railroads, and the railroads became huge and they became huge moneymakers, but there were boom towns, huge boom towns. I was in Colorado hiking last month, and there are these ghost towns, and they spring up and they existed for like 10 years because, you know, the railroad went through. They mined out all the silver or lead or copper that was there. And then they disappeared because it was mined out, or, you know, the population just gave up of being there. But during that 10-year period, I mean, people made fortunes. And so do I think like you can just buy Micron and hold it for the next 40 years and retire? No. But do I think Micron's got a longer window of stellar returns than 6 months to a year? Yes. I think it's got a multi-year time horizon for outperformance. And I think a lot of these AI names do. I think a lot of these chip stocks do. I think if you look at the Korean market, which has been selling off, it does. But you look at the Korean market, it's 50% of the Korean market is two stocks. It's SK Hynix and Samsung. The average stock in the S&P 500 trades within a 50% band every year. Well, if two stocks make up half of your index, and they're actually a little more volatile than your average stock, they're going to trade in the 60, 70, 80% band over the course of the year. That's going to drive 30, 40% fluctuations in the index. That should be expected. But what do investors get in return for increased volatility and risk? They get return. And I think people that are looking at Micron hitting the 50-day and buying it at 910, they might not be happy they did that a week from now. I think they're going to be very happy they did that 6 months from now, a year from now. And so I'm not here to say, look, this is what's going to happen. But if I had to do a short-term bet, I think what these stocks are waiting for is mega cap earnings coming in the next 2 weeks, and they want to hear Sundar Pichai, they want to hear Jassy, they want to hear these people say, we're still going to be spending. And they are, because they'd be shooting themselves in the foot if they came out and said, you know what, this whole AI thing was a waste. Look, they might say things like, look, we're experiencing some supply constraints on power, or, you know, there's some pushback on data center build out. And so our CapEx might actually not increase that much, might even decrease a little bit. Initial market reaction might be, oh my gosh, it's all over. But I think what people are going to realize is this is just not going away. Like, it's the spending's not going away. They've been worried about it since 2022 when this whole thing started. It goes through these micro rotations, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, there's OpenClaw. Oh my gosh, there's, you know, Anthropic is cash flow or heading into profitability. But oh no, they're not, because actually, you know, Colossus, they gave them. I mean, all this stuff keeps going on, and it's just, meanwhile, the valuations keep going up, the profits keep going up. And I think waiting and trying to call the top has just been the dumbest thing you could possibly do, because it is going to top. And I've had some thoughts that that's probably not too far away. I don't think it's necessarily 5 years away. It could be 2-3 years away. I think it's going to have to do more with fiscal concerns than the AI thing. But look, market's not going to be going up 25-35% a year forever. And there's probably going to be a 30-40% pullback, I think, by the end of the decade. But I just don't see it happening this year. And I think the earliest it could possibly happen is going to be next year, because the spending is just in place. I mean, the gears are going, and you can't stop the train, to kind of borrow a Lynn Alden phrase. You can't stop the AI train on a dime. It could stop eventually, but you can't stop it, you know, next quarter. It would be a multi-year phase out of it. And I think, you know, in the meantime, earnings are just, you know, they're at unbelievable record paces. We're going to do over $400 in earnings in the S&P 500. The PE is cheaper now on the S&P than it was at the beginning of the year. You've got companies like Samsung, which I know isn't in the S&P, but it's going to do over $200 billion in profit this year. And people are saying, why is this a $1 trillion company? Well, I mean, if I told you, look, I can make $100,000 a year the next 5 years in a row, I will give every single dollar to you. And then at the end of it, you're also going to own every single dollar I make after that for the rest of my life. I think $1 million is $500,000 is a pretty cheap price to pay. And that's what people are paying. I mean, I think some of the cheapest stocks I've ever seen in my life are these Korean memory names. I mean, it's just, I just don't understand how, like, three times earnings growing at 65-70%, and that's what, I mean, they've been growing well over that, but this is what's forecast for fiscal year 27. These PEG ratios are ridiculous. And people are selling it and saying it's a bubble, because they believe what? That somebody's going to come out and there's going to be a memory fairy that figures out, or look, Anthropic and OpenAI can blow up. That's not going to hurt Micron or SK Hynix or Samsung in the medium to long term. In the short term, yes. OpenAI blew up. It's going to hurt it. But AI is not going away. It requires memory. That's like saying, you know, when I was a kid, a big computer was the Commodore 64. If the Commodore 64 blows up and nobody wants to buy another Commodore 64 or another Atari 2600, then the whole video game industry is dead. No, that's not the case. These were the biggest two companies when I was a kid. They dominated it. Commodore 64, Jungle Hunt, you know, Atari 2600, Pac-Man. I mean, these were the games, the cartridges dominated video games. If you said those companies are going to be jacked S, you know, within a matter of years, therefore get out of all the video game suppliers. How did that go for you? And that's what people are saying. That's what Zitron's saying. OpenAI and Anthropic are shit companies. Those are the word he likes to use. He basically says they're scams. He says they're never going to be able to make a profit and they're going to go away. And because of that, the entire basically financial system is going to blow up and all of this debt of the hyperscalers is going to go away. He even referenced in a recent podcast the possibility of NVIDIA going bankrupt. Literally, he's talking about NVIDIA possibly going. He said it was unlikely, but he said it's possible NVIDIA is going to go bankrupt. I mean, Marty, this amount of fear mongering, and then it's played into, you listen to the kids booing at college. Like, there's this AI. A lot of people have talked about Sam Altman and Dario Modi being like it's like Mussolini and Hitler. Like, they're very bad spokesmen. Like, nobody likes these guys. They come across as arrogant. They come across as condescending. They're not relatable. And the stuff that they say a lot of the times, it just puts people off the wrong way. And I think, like, there's this whole thing where this is not going to necessarily end in OpenAI being a $10 trillion company. I don't know if it does, but even if OpenAI eventually becomes a Lucent Technologies, that doesn't mean that there's not going to be a Microsoft and an Amazon emerging from the internet / now AI ecosystem. And I just think trying to pick the exact time that this is going to happen, like, okay, next week, they're going to say CapEx is over and it's going to crash. I think you just want to stay invested, stay for the long term. But I think you also want to really stay diversified and not have everything in chips and AI. You want to have emerging markets, not just Korea, but things like Brazil. You want to have Bitcoin. You want to have gold. You want to have material sector. You don't want to put all your money in chips. It's number one, it's too volatile, you'll get blown out. And number two, the rotation is going to continue. And I think we're just, probably on the verge of getting started back into the whole gold Bitcoin debasement trade.
What's up, freaks? This episode is brought to you by Block's Bitcoin ecosystem. You probably know Cash App, you probably know Square. You definitely know BitKey if you've been listening to the show for the last couple of years. What matters most is that these are not disconnected, random products. They are part of a broader push to make Bitcoin easier to buy, easier to hold, and easier to use in the real world. Cash App helps people stack Bitcoin. BitKey helps people custody without turning self-custody into a weekend engineering product. Square helps merchants run their businesses and increasingly plug into the Bitcoin native payments rails. Listen, this is the kind of ecosystem Bitcoin needs. We've been talking about this on the show for a while. We know that we need the different parts to line up to make Bitcoin everyday money. Block is doing just that. Check the episode description for the current Cash App, BitKey, and Square links. Freaks, look at me. I'm glowing. I've got like an angel's halo going around me. You know why that is? Is I feel good. I feel taken care of. I feel blessed, healthy, happy. And that is because I'm a CrowdHealth member. My family and I have been CrowdHealth members for 5 years now. Literally this month, 5 years ago, we joined CrowdHealth. We've had two babies. We've had multiple health events, and we're never going back to health insurance. CrowdHealth is crowdfunded healthcare. So you sign up for CrowdHealth, you pay a monthly fee, you help out with other people's bills, and it's significantly cheaper than health insurance. We were on Cobra as a family of three when I left my last job before I went full-time to CFTC. Went on the CrowdHealth. Now as a family of five, we pay I believe $700 a month. It's significantly cheaper. They're going to negotiate prices lower for you. They've consistently negotiated healthcare prices as much as 50, 60, 80% in many cases. They help out with babies. If you have a pregnancy, you pay the first $3,000 and the crowd covers the rest. If you have a regular health event, you pay $500 and the crowd pays the rest. Go to joincrowdhealth.com. Sign up today. Use the code TFTC. Opt out of health insurance. I'm uninsured, baby, and I love it. Use the code TFTC at joincrowdhealth.com and you'll get $99 a month for the first 3 months that you're on the CrowdHealth platform in the community. Bitcoiners, you found sovereign money. Now find sovereign health.
and sovereign healthcare.
That's a good segue into the next topic, which is the Fed and macro. We were discussing before we hit record, a lot of people are beginning to price in rate hikes later this month. I think it's at 50-50 right now. If you look at the probability of there being a rate hike or them holding it steady, what's your take on this, Warsh? Again, coming in between now and our last interview, and how are you viewing all of this, Warsh, at the helm?
I do not think there's going to be any rate hikes. I think there's going to be rate cuts this year. Somebody who I respect, I've referenced him many times, is Jordy Visser. He's talked about a potential for Warsh to hike actually in July and do a surprise hike. This would essentially like assert Fed independence, but then talk it down and say that's it. So like a 25 basis point hike possibly, but nobody is even talking about like a major hiking cycle. And if you listen to Warsh, I think he comes off a little conceited sometimes too. I think he probably needs a better haircut, but he just does not strike me as someone who's oblivious to the broader macro concerns. As an example, in his first press conference, he was asked kind of a leading question about are financial conditions loose? And it was kind of a left-leaning journalist that you know, wanted him to somehow argue they're not. And he basically came back right away. He said, look, in housing, no, financial conditions are not loose. If you're a hyperscaler looking to borrow debt and spreads are at all-time heights, then yeah, financial conditions are not very tight. You know, it's pretty easy to borrow right now. And so we have this tale of two economies. We have a housing market, which has been the primary driver of the economy about half of the time, right? If you look at, okay, what happened when the dot-com boom bust? Housing took over. And then we had like a 5-6 year housing bubble. If you look at net worth of Americans, it's still mostly in real estate. So the biggest market in this country for your average American is real estate. It's the house. And that has just done nothing in recent years, really. There have been certain markets that are extremely supply constrained with kind of blue political leanings where they like in New York, where like, you know, they're just not building anything. And, you know, rents are over $5,000 a month right now for an average one bedroom in Manhattan. Prices have gone up in places like that. But if you live like where I do in North Carolina, I mean, you know, a house has not moved up or down more or less in the last 4 years. You know, you got to go back to the last World Cup, you know, to see, house prices cheaper or more expensive than they are right now. I mean, like housing just has not moved. And at the same time, during that period, nominal earnings, and I'm using nominal because housing prices haven't moved, are up like over 20%. So for your average American, if you want to buy a house in Durham, it's 20% cheaper now than it was 4 years ago. People say, well, what are you talking about, 20% cheaper? Because houses have not moved, nominal earnings are up that much, compounded over the last 4 years. And I can go down my street and look at Zillow and look at like what did a house sell for in like September 2022? And you put a house on the market right now, it's going to sell for the same thing. And then if you look at what is the average, you know, hourly earnings increase, nominal terms, not real, it's up over 20% compounded over the last 4 years. I mean, that's a 20% reduction in housing. And that's basically the biggest segment of wealth in the entire U.S. economy. And the most directly interest rate sensitive segment of the economy. So if you're Warsh and you're saying, okay, if I raise rates, what am I going to do? I'm going to hurt housing. That's going to hurt construction spending. That's going to hurt Joe Schmo American, where most of their wealth is in housing. Is it going to stop OpenAI from spending? Is it going to stop Meta from borrowing because their interest rate on their debt just went up 25 basis points? No, it's not. And so I think Warsh recognizes that the Fed's interest rate tool is a very blunt tool, and that by raising rates, he's not going to stop, you know, electricity inflation because of AI. Like, that's on a course that's absolutely separate from whatever, you know, the 2-year yield is at. And so all he's going to do is hurt the average person, and also stymie bank lending, which I think he wants to stimulate. And that goes into Bessin and Bessin's speech about, you know, tokenization, about deregulation. And so there's this big strategic narrative that I think the Trump administration has right. And then at the same time, we're fighting this big tactical narrative that I think the Trump administration has wrong. So they keep making these tactical mistakes, these fumbles, but their long-term strategic vision of embracing digital assets, embracing deregulation, letting AI, you know, letting America compete, bringing back manufacturing, all these broad strategic goals, you know, one big beautiful bill, depreciation, tax cuts, all of these are huge strategic tailwinds. But then at the same time, we keep getting these huge tactical headwinds, whether it's tariffs, Iran war, whatever. And this is the wall of worry the market keeps fighting, and we keep getting the ups and downs, we keep getting the rotations. And then at the end of the day, you look back and you say, oh my gosh, Apple's up 50% in the last 12 months.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the big strategy from Bessent and the Trump administration, what they're getting right long term, and then follow that up with what they're getting wrong and how they can maybe right course there.
Yeah, I think, you know, what, like I said, what they're getting right is, you know, deregulation. I think one thing that has not been understood enough is the relationship of the balance sheet to interest rates and what Warsh has said. So I think this is where the market has been getting it wrong. The market looked at Warsh. They see him as a hawk. They think he's going to like decrease the balance sheet. That's going to decrease money supply. Look, inflation and inflationary aspects are primarily driven by money supply. Money supply does not necessarily need to be increased by the Fed balance sheet. It can be increased by bank lending. It can be increased by the velocity of money. And those are the things that Warsh really wants to increase. He wants to start, and this is already starting, move back more lending from banks and less from private credit. Why is that important? If I'm a millionaire and I've got $100,000 I want to put into a bond issue, and I do it through private credit, I take that $100,000, it essentially gets withdrawn from the economy, and it goes, lends it to the company. Net, net, it's zero. I had $100,000 spending power. I now lose that $100,000 spending power. I loaned it to a company. They got $100,000 of spending power. If a bank says, I want to loan you $100,000, they credit your account $100,000, and then they debit their liabilities $100,000. There's no decrease. It's money printing. There have been so many people fed, you know, I'm a big central bank guy. The biggest printers of money are not central banks. It's commercial banks. Commercial banks, the reason they're regulated the way they are, the reason there's the OCC, the reason there's the FDIC, the reason there's the Fed is they can literally make credits on their balance sheet, debits on their balance sheet for their own liabilities and credit you with an asset. That's money printing. That's money creation. We had so much money being created through private credit. That's essentially, putting a ceiling on M2, right? And so we don't need the Fed's balance sheet to expand if commercial banks start lending more. This is what Warsh, the deregulation, this is all part of the Bessent plan. This is, you know, We don't need to raise interest rates every time growth comes up. We don't need to have a huge Fed balance sheet. You know, we can absorb treasury supply through stable coins or tokenization. We can. So there is this big, broad strategic plan that I believe is out there that I think is going to be necessary, because if you do not address, and we're already at over $800 billion in net interest expense this fiscal year, and we've still got the rest of July, August, and September. Fiscal year ends at the end of Q3. You know, people are worried about like $80 billion in Google equity raise. I mean, like, look, just net interest expense is over 10 times that already this year. And it's just growing. And this is the thing that is a nasty little secret. This is what my big concern is longer term, is that almost all of the expense of healthcare for an individual comes in the last 24 to 36 months of life. And we are just now getting into what I would call an accelerated death range for baby boomers, where if you look at, you know, when was World War II over? 1945. Okay, so the first boomers, let's say, born in 46. We're now exactly 80 years, right? So the oldest baby boomers are now 80. I don't know about you, but most of the people I know, they do pretty good in their 70s. I mean, there's always exceptions. Look at Lindsey Graham. But really where the health problems start cropping up for most of the older adults that I know is in their 80s. And boomers, this is the first year the oldest boomers are just hitting 80. And if you look at fiscal projections for Medicare and health spending, it's going to blow up. And so we're getting interest expense blowing up. At the same time, we're going to have healthcare spending blow up because boomers are hitting what I would call peak medical care years. And that's not going to end anytime soon. And it's just going to get worse. And so, like, if you look at we're going to hit $40 trillion in U.S. debt in the coming months. We're going to hit over $1 trillion in interest expense year to date in a couple months. How you can look at the U.S. dollar and not say, I want to own gold, I want to own Bitcoin, I want to own silver, in the same way that people thought was so smart 12 months ago, and the debasement, you know, guys from Morgan Stanley coming on Bloomberg, debasement trade. And now it's like, oh, look, AI stole a little bit of thunder from this. I mean, look, there's no question about it. Like, stuff's going up 4 or 5 times. But people are starting to see the easy money days are over. You know, Micron, I think, like I said, it could be $3,000 a share in the next 12 to 24 months, but that's not what it did in the last 12 to 24 months. And I think once people start to recognize this, and once people see the plan, the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is the largest bank regulator, was on CNBC today talking about how he just approved Circle to be a bank. You know, like this stuff is starting to happen where crypto, Bitcoin, they were fighting like up a river for 4 years under Biden. Like he basically said, like Carl Quintanilla asked, like, aren't you worried about giving Circle a bank license? He's like, look, all I'm doing is following the statutes and the laws as they're written. And I can speak from firsthand experience that until recently, if you mentioned crypto to a regulator, you were like, you know, you just didn't do it. I started 3 different broker dealers, SecFi Securities, Equity Securities, Vested Securities. They're all broker check. People want to start them as the CEO of them. I went through the whole FINRA application process with all 3 of them. 2 as new broker dealers, 1 as a continuing application, which is where you buy a broker dealer and then you apply for another broker dealer license. every single time. And we had the best Manhattan attorneys that advised us. We were VC funded and we had these fancy guys from a firm called Lowenstein Sandler. Every single time they would tell us, look, just don't mention crypto. Like, once you mention that, you're going to be persona non grata. You're going to go to the back of the list if you have to mention it, but otherwise allude to you might go into other aspects of business. Like, it, and there was no legislative statute law in the books that said if you're involved with cryptocurrencies, you can't have a broker dealer or you can't have a bank. There's no law prohibiting it. It was just a stance that the regulators took because they were essentially in the back pockets of the big banks. And it was a threat to the big banks, and it is a threat to the big banks. This is the whole reason why the Clarity Act hasn't been passed yet, because, you know, the banks do not want, you know, stablecoin issuer like Circle basically paying out interest and not being regulated like a bank. Well, guess what? Now Circle's a bank. So we're going to get through these hurdles and we're going to get over this. We had Securitize, SECZ is the ticker, go public via SPAC a week or so ago. You know, it traded down quite a bit and I actually bought some late last week and some today. I'm not making an investment recommendation, but, you know, it went public with SPAC, traded up to like 14 and got down to $6.66. Last week. And, you know, this is a tokenization company, you know, blockchain, again, to reference Jordy Visser, he likes to talk about agents, the agentic economy. It's going to be, you know, they're not going to be using dollars. Once people start to realize this, they're going to say, oh my gosh, I need to be there. Just like a year ago, people were like, oh my gosh, debasement trade, I need to be there in gold and silver. Then it ramps up, you know, 150%, sells off, everybody hates it for 6 months, and then it starts again. And so I think the same thing is happening right now with some of these chip stocks. And what was hated, some of the hyperscalers, like I said, I mean, they're having amazing returns. I mean, I don't know. I mean, just look at something really quick, like a Meta. I mean, this thing was literally $540 a share, like 5-6 days ago, and today it hit $675. But yet, if you hear people talk about, oh, Meta hyperscalers, what a dog. Well, look, these things are in ranges. They're trading around. The money is moving, and I think at the end of the day, If you're going to argue, and maybe this could be our last quick topic, would be like the Trump accounts, like what's going to keep this party going? It's just an endless stream of passive bid. This is a Michael Green argument. It's, you know, PEs can blow up. They don't need to stay at 25. They could go to 30, 35, like, because the passive bid is not going away and it's only getting augmented by the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars a year in perpetuity, just from one law going into effect on July 4th, which is the Trump accounts.
So, freaks, when you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about one out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their motto is simple. You hold two keys, they hold one key. It always takes two keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
All right, freaks. You know me. You know I don't take sponsor money from products I wouldn't use myself. So listen up.
The Aave Bitcoin Visa card is one of the most interesting things I've seen in the Bitcoin lending space in a long time. Here's the deal. You can get a line of credit up to $1 million backed by your Bitcoin without selling a single sat. No games, no annual fees, no minimum draws, and your Bitcoin is custodied by BitGo, which is one of the most trusted names in digital asset security. Aave never lends it out. There's no rehypothecation. You stay in control. And guess what? You can lock in a fixed rate for up to 10 years. That's 10 times longer than most lenders out there, or go interest only for up to 5 years. Rates start at 7.99% APR for a product that lets you keep your stack and still access liquidity. It's hard to beat. I mean, the duration in the rates is the best I've seen in the market to date. You also get 2% unlimited cash back every time you use the card. Spend fiat, keep your Bitcoin, the whole game. If you've been stacking for years and you need liquidity without triggering a taxable event, this is worth a serious look. Go to aave.com/Bitcoin. That's aave.com/Bitcoin. Check it out.
What should we follow there in terms of adoption to then try to port to the flows that you just described? Like what, because everybody has access to a Trump account. You have to physically go out and get them for your kids. How's this going to play out in your mind?
I think it's being way underestimated by the market, because I don't think people fully understand the tax advantage of these accounts. And it's not just $1,000 that the government's going to give. It's the ability for anybody to give to a kid that, and it's up $5,000 a year. And it's available to every single person under 18 years of age. So every American under 18 can go create, or their parents can go create a Trump account. Not a, if you're 16, you're not going to get $1,000. So it's like you have to be born, I think, since Trump took office or something, 2025, 2026. There's a lower age range where you get the $1,000. And then there's other people making big gifts, like Michael Dell, Brad Gerstner, different people that are, you know, like Gerstner's just doing the state of Indiana. But the big thing is the tax advantage savings of it, which is that, okay, I talked about boomers turning 80. We all know boomers have $70+ trillion in wealth. They can put $5,000 a year for each of their grandkids into this account, and it's going to grow for their grandkids tax-free. When they're 18, if the kid wants, they can roll this over into a Roth IRA. And then when they're 59, they can take it out tax-free. There have been some studies showing that if a kid that's born now and for the next 18 years, $5,000 is contributed, which granted, that's a lot of decent amount of money. It's less than $100,000 though, that should the markets perform as they have, by the time that kid is 59 and a half and could withdraw it, it should be between $13 and $15 million, because you're starting that early. This is the power of compounding. It's the same thing that AI guys talk about, how humans think linearly. We don't speak exponentially, or Einstein talking about compounding, the most powerful force in the universe. And you're like, you know, is that really right? Like, you put $90,000 into some kid's account and he's going to have $13 million. Well, yeah, because of compounding, because it's that many years. It's 60 years. We're starting from year zero when the kid's born to 59 and a half. So it's called 60 years. Nominally, S&P's up 10, 11% a year. You're putting that money in. And so whether that's going to happen or not, that can be up for debate. What I don't think is going to be up for debate is that there's going to be a lot of well-off grandparents putting money into their grandkids' accounts. Now, what has to happen with that? It goes in the S&P 500 and it can't be sold, right? I mean, the kid can't, I put it into my six-year-old grandchild. I just put 5,000 in, you know, next month I'm going to sell it. No. This is a passive bid. It's an unstoppable passive bid because every year there's new kids born. So I think it's 3.5 million kids born Some of these numbers were gone through on a recent All In podcast with Brad Gerstner, which I think really spells all this out well. And, you know, they don't tie it necessarily to S&P returns. They just talk about the great tax savings. But I think if you combine what they're talking about, the tax savings, combine that with Michael Green's, you know, passive bid thesis, combine that with the fiscal deficits and that we literally can't clamp down on inflation. Like, we can't just start raising interest rates when the government is primarily funding itself through U.S. Treasury bills and start hiking up those rates when we're running over $1 trillion a year. Like, Lou Grohman, you know, what are you going to do? Sacrifice the currency or bonds, right? I mean, like, are we either going to let the bond market blow up or are we going to sacrifice the currency, in other words, inflation? We're going to have that. Now, there's going to be counterproductive or counter forces with productivity. But at the end of the day, this whole market fear, oh, my gosh, we've got the second coming of Paul Volcker in the Fed chair seat. And he's just going to start hiking rates because inflation's at 3.2%, which I wouldn't be surprised if tomorrow, and it's always risky making a call less than 24 hours before a number comes out. I wouldn't be surprised if we're well below expectations tomorrow on CPI and even more low next month. And I think we could have some deflationary prints, like literally negative numbers, especially if the Trump administration would get out of its way a little bit with this Iran stuff, because those are the tactical headwinds I talked about. But when you had oil go from $120 a barrel down to a six handle in a matter of weeks, I mean, that's going to be good for reducing inflation. So I think, you know, all these signs, like there's so much noise out there. There's a lot of volatility. But like, if you just can block that out and say, look, I think I want to have a 4% allocation to memory stocks, 12% allocation to gold, 8% allocation to Bitcoin, whatever those allocations are right for you, and hold on to them, you're going to be very happy with where you're at in 6 months, 12 months from now. And I just mentioned that because there are a lot of doomer voices out there. There are a lot of people saying this AI thing is going to blow up, private credit is going to blow up, they, you know, the Iran war is going to send oil to 200. There are a lot of people that I think could be scaring people into saying, oh my gosh, I need to take my money out of all risk assets and put it into a CD. I think that's going to be the wrong decision. I could always be wrong, but I mean, I'm about as bullish as I've ever been. I think 15,000 by the end of the decade on S&P, for example, is probably conservative.
Yeah. You've always been very bullish on the show. And it seems like it's, I mean, the AI stuff, like when I hear Ed Zitron, I have to wonder, like, is there some sort of nefarious incentive driving it? Or is he not using it the right way? Because
he just sells his research. He makes money on that.
Yeah. But is the research good? Like, because I'm using the stuff. Mm-hmm. We've like basically automated a ton of the back end stuff at TFTC. And like I said, my token usage is going up exponentially, it feels, particularly with the new frontier models launching. We're hopping on them right away. And it's undeniable, like objectively, just looking at my micro situation, mm-hmm. looking at my business, like it is helping us be crazy productive. Like it is a multiple on productivity. The costs are manageable for us as a small team. Maybe that's different for enterprises. And it does seem like enterprises are trying to figure out how to manage token spend and what the right mix of frontier models and open source models is. But I think to flatly say that this is a bubble built on idiotic technology that hallucinates.
Nothing. Yeah. And he claims it's nothing. He doesn't even make the claim that like OpenAI and Anthropic are, you know, insecure business models. Like he literally makes the claim that we're going to look back on this period and say this was the biggest waste ever, and we're going to be like massively oversupplied with compute. And I will grant him that there's no guarantee, like I said, that OpenAI becomes a $10 trillion company one day. In fact, I kind of doubt it ever does. But that does not mean that AI, that data center builds outs are worthless. Meta, like I made this argument months ago where I was basically like, look, everybody's talking about shortages of compute. The hyperscalers own compute. Microsoft owns compute with Azure, you know, Amazon with AWS, Meta with what they built out for themselves, which they're now selling, Google with Google Cloud and what they built out for Gemini. They own compute. If there's a need for compute, it doesn't matter if it comes through OpenAI, Anthropic, Grok, GLM, you know, Kimi, Minimax, like it doesn't matter, Quinn, the Baba model. Like if it needs to be computed, it needs the hardware. And the hardware is going to be valuable because that demand is going up crazy. And like you talked about and mentioned earlier, we're not even getting into robotics. I mean, we're not even getting into all this stuff. And like, is a lot of that stuff going to be on the edge? Yes. But guess who's going to make the memory for the robots, right? So it's like, you know, mine the miners. You know, this is the railroads, man. I mean, it was like the same thing, picks and shovels, mine the miners. You know, like I said, honestly, I would not invest in Anthropic or OpenAI right now. I just wouldn't. I mean, not anything significant. And I think we've seen SpaceX, you know, not have that great of a reaction in the market. So I think there's a valid criticism that when people are willing to draw out, like, where's SpaceX going to be in 15 years? Like, who the heck knows where SpaceX is going to be in 15 years? And so that deserves a pretty heavy discount, even if you grant that it's going to access this $24 trillion TAM. And it's like, granted it all, but you got to discount the hell out of that. But was it a big leap once the automobile was invented to say autos are going to be a big thing? Didn't know if Ford was going to be great, Studebaker, a lot of companies went bankrupt, a lot of railroads went bankrupt, a lot of dot-coms went bankrupt. But at the end of the day, this was a transformational technology. I just don't see how, and Zitron argues this a lot of the times, he basically says AI is not a transformational technology. Like it's not good. It doesn't do anything. It hallucinates. It's like, look, it's getting better every month. It does a lot of stuff. I mean, I'll tell you what, you could make the same argument about a word processor. You could be like, oh, what's a computer? It's a keyboard. I already have a typewriter. It's not transformational. I mean, sometimes the differences don't even have to be that huge. Just the fact that you can now talk to computers is huge, right? I mean, before the big LLMs, the best talking, you know, back and forth was like Alexa and Siri, and they all sucked. And now, like, I'm like, you know, you start talking to these models and they're picking up on slang, you're picking up on, like, that is just a huge, huge leap. I mean, it's so easy to, you know, imagine like glasses and, you know, automatically, you know, translating and all the stuff that these things have already proven they can do are huge. They just haven't been fully implemented in society yet because people don't change as fast as the technology does, but they will get implemented. Just like I'm old enough that when I was a kid, we had a radio, we had a rotary phone, and we had a dial black and white TV with an antenna. Okay, that was the like epitome of electronics in like a 1981 household. There were people that first got VHSs, then they got betas. My dad didn't like that stuff. There were people that got cable. My dad didn't like that stuff. There were kids that got video games. I mentioned the Commodore 64, the Atari 2600. My dad didn't like that stuff. He bought a new video game console called the Atari 400, which even though it was less than the Atari 2600, it was actually more expensive, but it was supposed to be a better computer, but nobody liked it. Everybody liked the 2600. So like all this stuff happened. All this stuff happened and these companies came and went, but they have literally just transformed the world over what is a relatively short period of time. I mean, it's not like the iPhone's been around for even a decade. right? I mean, it came out in 2007. For 20 years. It hasn't even been around for 20 years. I mean, that is not a long time. I got pairs of socks older, been around longer than iPhones. Like, this stuff changes the world, and AI is going to change the world. That's not going to end. Does that mean, SpaceX can't trade down to $30 a share in the next 24 months? Sure it can. I actually don't think it will. But yeah, I mean, that thing's got barely any revenue. It's not profitable. I'm just saying, like, would I want to put a bunch of money into SpaceX? No, I own some shares. I got a little allocation on the IPO, and I bought some the very first day, small amount, and I just put it away because I do believe in the potential of it. But like, I'm not going to like be a SpaceX maxi. Like, let me put it all into that, you know? And I think like a diversified portfolio, crypto, Bitcoin, gold, silver, equities, emerging market equities, like everything except for bonds. I just don't like bonds because I just don't see a way for the fixed income return to keep up with the inflation that's going to be necessary to handle the fiscal issues that every major developed country from Japan to UK to France to the United States, to even China, just swamped in it. And the basement trade's not hot right now. That doesn't mean it won't be, 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, it's not hot. It's the best time to allocate, typically.
It is. It's every single time. People hate the hyperscalers. It's ridiculous how many times when everybody thinks it's the smartest thing to do, that's when everybody's invested in it and it's got nowhere to go but down. Like about 4 weeks ago, everybody's like, you got to bet on the builders, you don't bet on the spenders, get out of the hyperscalers. Everybody was saying that hyperscalers knocking the socks off of the, quote unquote, the picks and shovel plays in the last 3 or 4 weeks, because it just gets overdone and the narrative gets old. And now you've got Micron down a few hundred bucks from the high. And you've got Meta up $80 in the last couple of trading days. And people are saying, what the hell happened? Like, I thought a month ago you were supposed to buy Micron and sell Meta. No, actually, a month ago you were supposed to sell Micron and buy Meta. And it's like, longer term, I think you just be diversified because it's hard to pick the perfect dates. Right? I mean, like, when am I going to pick that perfect day that Meta's topped or Micron's topped? And I think you just want to be involved in these long-term themes. And this is why, even when like Bitcoin and gold were ripping last year, and I did once in a while go on a podcast and someone would say, Mel, you believe so much in gold and Bitcoin and the debasement trade, why do you own equities? I'm like, it doesn't mean that the debasement trade is always going to be, doing what I think it's going to do. Do I think gold and Bitcoin will outperform the S&P 500 over the next 10 years? Yes, I do. And I still do. But it's not happening this year. And you know what? It's good to have that diversity. There's an old saying in investing, the only free lunch in investing is diversity, because it increases your sharp ratio. It reduces the volatility, it increases your expected returns. And that's why I've never been a fan of like, just put every dollar you own into Bitcoin, or put it all into ETH, or put it all into gold, or put it all into the NASDAQ, or put it all into Monster or NVIDIA or Strategy. I do believe in diversification, and you want to take short-term bets, take short-term bets, but I do it with a small percentage of the portfolio. Most of it is a long-term diversified portfolio.
I think that's sage advice. Any predictions between now and the next time we meet after Q3?
Let me see if I can come up with a shocker for you, Marty. You're my favorite person to talk to. I don't know if I have anything that's actually too out of consensus or crazy. I do think that with gold right around 4,000, Bitcoin not too far away from 60, that the next time we meet, I would wager that gold and Bitcoin are going to be outperformers relative to equities and even some high flying equities. I would much rather invest in Bitcoin or gold right now than I would Micron or SpaceX. Doesn't mean I don't think they're not good. I just think that especially by the end of the year, we could be looking at some really, really nice returns. I think this was before we came on, but we're like 3 months away from the 4-year anniversary of the FTX low in Bitcoin. And it was October 2022, 16,000, 4-year cycle. I wasn't a believer in 4-year cycles, but you know what? We seem to be following one pretty damn well. And if we're going to bond 4 years after the last bottom, and that's October, we're in the middle of July. I mean, like, if people have said, okay, Bitcoin winter, like, well, winter's getting ready to end because, you know, if we're bottoming in the next couple of months, you know, I think you need to be start adding now. And, you know, to me, Bitcoin 57,000, whatever it hit last week. I mean, that's a gift. Gold at 4,000, silver 60. Now's the time to be buying those things. Not, you know, I don't know what's the hottest thing out there and on the books these days. Not SpaceX, in my opinion. That's
yeah. Yeah, it is funny. The 4-year cycle does seem to be repeating. And no, it's always good to zoom out with you, Mel. I think this was like the most dense high signal sort of we've ran through all this in an hour and 8 minutes here now. So thank you for coming on. Let's catch you up in the fall when Q3 is over. And I'm always looking forward to our end of year retrospective and predictions for the following year. So it's going to be a fun one.
I'm too. And I've got a few that I'm actually thinking could still come to fruition that nobody thought. One of them was Mag 7 outperforms S&P 500. I had Bitcoin outperforming gold. You know, I had some things that didn't seem to make sense back in January that I predicted at the end of the year. And they still don't make sense, to be honest with you. But I think there's still plenty of time left in the year for some of those things to come full circle. And I think a lot of people that kind of gave up on the Mag 7 early in the year or gave up on Bitcoin and thought gold was the bee's knees as it hit 5,600 and there's no way Bitcoin's going to outperform it. I still think Bitcoin's going to outperform gold for 2026. And I still think Mag 7 is going to outperform S&P.
Clip it and send it to Peter Schiff, freaks. Mel, we'll catch up in the fall, brother. Enjoy the rest of your summer.
All right. Thanks, Marty.
Peace and love, freaks. Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad-free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad-free. Helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time. And until next time.